Hi, everyone. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you first to Billy for asking me to come up and speak. I've been looking forward to coming out here for some time. This is my first time in Madison, so I'm very excited to be here. My sobriety date is September 6, 2009. I have a sponsor. Who has a sponsor? I have worked the 12 steps. I have a home group, and this month I have a job in that home group. I say these things because these are the things that keep me sober. If I didn't do these things, I wouldn't be here right now, and my quality of life would certainly be significantly diminished. Most likely you'd find me in the county jail or in a ditch or 6 feet underground. And it sounds hard to open that way, but that's just the way it is for an alcoholic of my type. I'm here to talk about what happened, and how it is now. I'll start my story with Bill's story, and I'll probably refer to Bill's story a lot as I talk about it because I feel a lot of affinity for it, and I relate so much to the words and to the experiences contained. We'll start. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. And, you know, my sponsor says we all have a Hampshire grenadier, and I certainly do. For me, it's my grandfather. I say that I grew up with the ghost of my grandfather very present in my home. I don't mean that in a X-Files supernatural kind of way, though that would have been quite exciting, I'm sure. What I mean is that my grandfather, my mother's father, was an alcoholic, and he never sought treatment. Never did the steps, never got where we got, and died the alcoholic death. My mother was very clear about this, and I remember from a very young age, you know, anytime she would talk about Grandpa, you know, she would tell me about how he died. And she never told me anything that was too, how do I put this, that was inappropriate for a child to hear. As I got older, she began to explain a little bit further, you know, about his drinking problems, the things that he did when he was drunk, the way that he acted when he was not drunk, and ultimately how cirrhosis of the liver combined with all of these other things brought him to death, and I consider that to be death by alcoholism. It's important for me to talk about that because I want you guys to know that when I grew up, you know, I had a single mom, one other brother. You know, she worked 2, 3, 4 jobs, whatever she had to do to keep food on the table, roof over my head, and to make sure that I didn't ever want for anything. You know, we weren't wealthy, but I can't ever recall a time where my mom wasn't doing everything that she could to make me happy. And part of that is that she never, one time, has ever taken a drink, to my knowledge, since I've been born. She certainly, if she ever took a drink, a glass of champagne or wine or whatever at a party, she never did it in front of me. The experience that she had with her own father so strong as to warrant an abstinence from drinking for my entire life, and again to this day. I think I was curious about drinking as a kid because, you know, we had a very strong relationship with her three brothers. They were sort of my father figures, and they drank casually. You know, one of them, I think, came about as close. The book talks about the hard drinker, the frequent drinker. I think, you know, he got there and got about as close to alcoholism as he was comfortable with, and then, you know, he backed off. And I remember being a kid at Thanksgiving or whatever, and one of my uncles would be drinking a can of Coors Light, and I'd be like, hey, can I try some of that? You know, like a kid would. And, of course, no, you know, when you're older, you'll get to do it, you know, whatever you want. But I can tell you about my first drink. My first drink was not a spiritual experience for me. A lot of people, when I hear them talk about their first drink, they say, oh, the world opened up and everything happened and it was just, it all started to make sense for me. You know, I was maybe 13 years old. I was hanging out downtown Charlottesville a lot because that's what you do when you're 13 years old. You hang out, you don't do anything. And you make problems for the businesses of the downtown mall, you know, by loitering. And, you know, I was a pretty awkward kid. I had spent a lot of time homeschooled, so I didn't really know how to make friends. I wasn't comfortable around other kids. I didn't have the same kind of relationship with sports that other kids had. I didn't, you know, interacting with people didn't come natural to me. And so I was hanging out downtown a lot around people who, you know, I was acquainted with. I knew who they were, but I didn't know them really well, and that seemed to work okay. They didn't ask too much of me. So, and I remember hanging out with these two kids, and an older guy came up to us and said, "Hey, you guys, guess what? This hobo just got arrested." Okay, so, well, he left his duffel bag in the park, and it's full of beer. Well, it seemed like this was a thing that these kids were pretty excited about, so I decided to get kind of excited about it, too. You know, I didn't want to not fit in. I didn't want to be the odd man out. So I said, okay, cool, yeah, cool. They told us where it was, and, you know, I think I went by myself, and sure enough, hidden in this bush in the park was this big green duffel bag, and I unzipped it, and it was full of beer. I pulled one out, closed the bag up, and took off running as fast as I could. Didn't want to get caught, you see. And I ended up hiding behind a wall in a parking lot for another park, I think, and found myself staring at a warm bottle of Bud Ice. Real quality stuff. I started out with the good stuff, as you can see. You know. And I remember I opened it up, and I think I drank it as fast as I could because I was so terrified about getting caught. And immediately stashed the bottle somewhere and ran back to my friends. Yeah, I did it. It's great. Yeah, awesome. But I think the adrenaline, that fear of like being punished for what I was doing, I knew sort of intrinsically what I was doing was wrong. And I was so terrified about that, that any adrenaline that I had in my system must have negated the alcoholic effect that was going on there, because I don't remember feeling any different. There was no light in the sky. There was no, my life is changing. Now, my first drunk, on the other hand, now that was a spiritual experience. We're talking a whole other deal here. You know, by this point, I had fallen in with a group of people who I felt like I knew pretty well, most of them, you know, pretty significantly older than me. I was maybe 15 at this point. And, you know, we liked to get together at a friend's house, and once there was a big enough group of us that we felt like we could cause some trouble, we'd go downtown and we'd start hopping all the art galleries and parties and openings and everything that was going on. And I remember this one specific night, there was a party going on in the basement of the Jefferson Theater. And I went downstairs, and it was like the first thing I saw was sitting up on this counter was one of those big orange igloo, they're not called thermoses, they're those big like cooler things that you know, you see them at football games and things. And it was like yesterday to me. I could still tell you what it looked like. It was orange, and there were no people around it. There must have been a spotlight, because I swear I saw it. You know. And written in Sharpie on the top, SPIK'D. And I thought, hey, this is my kind of party, right? Yeah, all my friends are like getting drinks, and I'm like, wow, maybe this is, I can do this too, you know? This will be all right. And man, it was like entering a different world, you know. All of my anxiety about being around strangers, gone. You know, all of my fear of what these people thought of me, gone. I was like the life of the party in an instant. I was everybody's best friend. You know, anybody who wanted something good to do, I was right there, man. I was right there in the middle of it. And, you know, I couldn't tell you with any real certainty that I've spent the rest of my drinking career trying to recapture that feeling. I'd like to think that I did, because at least that sounds like something kind of productive, you know. But the reality of the situation is that once I got my taste of what being drunk was like, I was off to the races. There was never a point going forward in my life where one or two drinks was enough. You know, it was always, I'm going to drink as much as I can, as fast as I can, until I'm blacked out, passed out, in the bed, unmoving, waking up the next day. I mean, this was not a social thing for me. This was not, let me loosen up and have fun with my friends. This was, I need to find some oblivion, and I need to find it fast. Fast forward a couple years, you know, met a girl when I was 18, started living with her, because that seemed like the right thing to do at the time. You know, 18 years old, got my own place. Why should I not have a girl living with me? I don't care what you guys think. I don't care if you think I'm too young. I'm doing this. Married by 20. Against the good wishes of my friends and family, who all thought I was too young. Of course, they had no idea what they're talking about. I mean, come on. How would they know what's right for me? I mean, come on. This is my life. I can live it. I know what I'm doing. Less than a year later, I was $80,000 in debt. with a 3,000 square foot house I had no business owning, and a car in my name that I had no idea how to drive. No, it's not that my license was taken away. No, I just never learned. You know, the extent of, like, the you know, I never really, I don't think I could adequately put into words with you the amount of havoc that I wreaked in the lives of my loved ones just deciding to get married. You know, just going against their wishes, just trying to make a stand against these people to tell them that, you know, I knew what I needed and they had no idea. I moved to Stanton and bought the house. Huge house, 3,000 square foot house. Only house on West Beverly Street with off-street parking. I mean, it was massive. But I had no idea what to do with all that, you know? I had a job. It was a pretty good job. My wife didn't work at the time. But we kind of felt like buying a house was what adults do, so we were going to buy a house. But, you know, the funny thing about it is when you're 21 years old and you try to force yourself into these responsibilities that you're not prepared for, things do not turn out well. And it was at this point in my life that I started to drink every single day. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle being responsible. I couldn't handle having bills to pay. I couldn't handle having to be the guy who fixed the house when the house broke down. You know, it was really easy to rent as a teenager. Your water heater breaks, call the landlord. Get a new water heater, free of charge. Awesome. You know, but when we moved into our house on day one and the water heater blew up when the power came on, kind of heavy, you know? And alcohol was a really easy out for me. It was something that I knew I could do well. You know, I very rarely got sick. I could drink a lot, and I mean a lot. I had an aptitude for it. But I very rarely, you know, even when I got hungover, the worst I had was a headache. Sometimes, maybe once in a blue moon, I'd throw up once or twice. And I knew that if I got drunk, I knew that if I did that, all of these problems would not go away. I don't want to make you think that I had some, you know, some ideas about them disappearing into thin air. But at least for an hour, 2 hours, maybe an evening if I was lucky, I didn't have to think about it. And that was good enough for me at the time. You know, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't take it. And the person who got the brunt of that more than anybody else was my wife, my now ex-wife. And that's a situation that, you know, I needed a scapegoat. You know, I needed somebody that I could look at, because the idea of taking responsibility was so completely foreign to me that it was almost like asking me to speak a different language, you know, to say I'm sorry, to say I need help, to say I've gotten in over my head. I mean, I couldn't do it. These were concepts that were foreign. So it was really easy for me to look at another person and be like, it's your fault. You're the reason why I'm here. You're the reason why I have all this debt. You're the reason why I have to work so much. You're the reason why we can't keep our heads above water. And there was no way out that I could see. Simply no way out. And then an incredible thing happened. A miracle in my eyes, you know. My mom, in Charlottesville, was diagnosed with leukemia. And yeah, that was a miracle for me. You know, my own mom getting diagnosed with cancer, I saw this as a miracle. It was like a sign from God. It was like my road away from the hell that I had been living towards some new path. It was like, yes, it couldn't have happened soon enough as far as I was concerned. Because this meant that I could leave the house behind. I could leave the unhappy wife behind. All the debt, all the horror, everything that had happened in that relationship. Sorry, honey. Got to go back to Charlottesville and take care of my mom. Got to be the good son. Got to be the Superman. You know, forget about anything that I may have done. Forget about anything that I needed to take care of. This new problem came up, and I was going to solve it, period. So I came to Charlottesville. I spent a good, you know, couple of months paying rent at my mom's house, paying rent at an apartment for me to live in, and paying my mortgage back in Stanton. And if that wasn't overwhelming, I don't know what As if getting myself the house itself wasn't enough. You know, I needed to have some bigger thing to be responsible, some bigger crisis, some bigger other thing that I had to be taken care of. And, you know, if you would have asked me then, I would have said, hell yeah, I drink. Yeah, absolutely I do. Yeah, I get drunk too. What's your problem? You know, my mom's sick. My marriage is in shambles. I have to spend all this money. Who wouldn't drink if they were in my shoes? And then you know, Mom got better. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, all these reasons that you used to tell yourself, these are why you drink, the reasons why you justify to your friends and family why you drink the way you do, they're all gone. Mom's better. Ink on the divorce papers are dry. House is sold. And my brother, God love him, took the car and the car payment, took it out of my name, the car I couldn't drive anyway, you know. Everything seemed okay, right? So maybe I don't need to drink anymore. That lasted about as long as me going out to dinner with my now live-in girlfriend and having her saying, hey, honey, your favorite beer is on sale tonight. You should have one. See, I didn't need a reason to drink the way I drank, you know. I could tell you that I drank the way I did because my mom got sick, because my marriage was in shambles, or because I had all this debt that I had no idea what to do with, and I was working way harder than I felt like I had to deal with it. You know, I don't need those reasons. You know, the drink's good enough. You know, I'll drink for anything. I'll drink in good times. I'll drink in bad. You know, it doesn't matter why I'm doing it. All that mattered to me was that I was doing it. But, you know, after a while, I decided I'm going to be a big guy about this. No reason to drink. Doesn't seem to be doing me any good anymore. I'm going to quit. I didn't set a date. If you ask me now, I couldn't even remotely tell you when it was. I just said, I'm done. I don't need help. I don't need AA. I'm the person who decides to drink. I'm the person who decides not to drink. Pure and simple, right? Oh, had I known. And it even says so in our literature, you know. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. Right? Yeah, I got this. And, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I white-knuckled it through a couple of years. Nearly 4 years like that. And I had some good times, too. You know, I was in a band. We were playing all over the country. CDs were selling well. That seemed to be doing okay. I, you know, fallen in love again. Gotten married again. That seemed to be going okay. I had a good job, a job I liked, a job that I didn't have to give up to do the things I wanted to do, like go on tour, so the bills could still get paid. Life on the surface looked pretty good for me those couple of years. Scratch that surface and try to get any deeper, and what you'd find is that I was miserable. I was completely overwhelmed, morning, noon, and night, every single day with my obsession to drink. You know, like I said, I'll drink in good times and in bad. You know, every minute, I cannot stress this enough, was, God, this would be better if I could just have a drink. You know, if something bad happened, it would, man, I would feel so much better if I could just take a drink right now. You know, if I was at a party, something good was happening, we were celebrating, or, man, wouldn't this be so much better if we could just all have some drinks? Wouldn't that be great? You know, and I didn't have any friends who drank like I did. You know, or I had people who I thought were friends that drank like I did. You know, but the reality was when I decided to quit drinking, all of a sudden, I didn't have a whole lot in common with them anymore. So the people who were around me didn't even understand why I wanted to drink the way I did. You know, and that's in the literature too. You know, they talk about, you know, oh, you know, if only, you know, she's a nice girl, you'd think he'd quit for her. Oh, the doctor says he'd do it, you'd think he would do it, you know, but here he is, all lit up again. You know, they understood me wanting to drink even less than they understood me drunk. You know, they could look at me and the things that I had been through, the things that I had said and done, the havoc that I had wreaked in the lives of my loved ones, and they would go, why? Why is this still a problem? You know, you're doing so well. It's been a year. It's been 2 years, you know. But none of that mattered to me. None of it. Absolutely not. You know, all I could think about every minute of every day was how much I wanted to just be able to let go, you know, to seek that oblivion again. Because I wasn't making any kind of, you know, bones about it. You know, I didn't think, I'd never at any point thought that just one was going to be enough for me. I didn't want to just have one or two drinks. It was, I want to get drunk. I want to fall down, black out, passed out, drunk every day of my life. And, you know, when you're in a band and you're touring all over the country playing in bars, you get confronted with a lot of the darker sides of what we, you know, we get to experience. And, man, if that didn't make me angry. I mean, anger was probably the one emotion that can define that you know, nearly 4-year period of my life. I was angry at you because you could drink and not have the consequences that I had. You know, I was angry at you because you were drinking and you were having the consequences and I couldn't join you. You know, I was angry at you because you didn't want to drink. Well, what do you know? I mean, I stayed in that perpetual cycle of I want to drink. I hate myself for wanting to drink. I want to drink. He's drinking. Fuck that guy. Excuse me. Sorry. And there was even one time, you know, when I was out on tour, and I love telling this story, I was in a different time zone. I wasn't even in a different state. I mean, I was way the heck away from home. And my second wife, you know, she went out with a friend of hers, and, you know, they went out and they did their thing, and they had fun, they went dancing, she had a couple drinks, and then, you know, went home at the end of the night. Because she's not like me, you know, she's not one of us, you know. And I'll never forget when I came home from that tour, and I said, hey, so what'd you do this week? You know, what you been up to? And she says, oh, you know, well, Tuesday night I went out with so-and-so, and we went to this place, and we went dancing, we had a couple drinks, and how could she do this to me? How? That was my response. You know, she's not like me. She goes out with some friends, maybe has a couple drinks, goes home, end of the night. That was such a huge affront to me personally. Now, you know I don't drink. You know I can't drink. Why would you do that? Never mind that I was in a different time zone altogether, doing my own thing when it happened. You know, the idea that she would get to go out and have a couple drinks with a friend of hers, man, I'd like to never forget that. You know, she may as well, you know, let one of the cats starve to death for all, you know, my response. And I'll refer back to the book again, you know, because I feel like so much of what happens in my life happened here first. Here it is. You know, for all my bluster, for all of my I don't need your help, I'm just not drinking, you know. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. It was my birthday. I'm a Virgo. And it just so happened that around this time, my wife was going out of town. A couple friends of mine were going out of town to do a gig. My best friend and his wife were going on a cruise together. And all of a sudden, my immediate circle of friends, the people that I talked to every day, almost every day, were all gone. Or they were going to be gone, I should say. And I remember this because we joked about it. You know, even like my brother and I and my mom and I, we kind of ribbed each other about it. You know, what's David going to do? Everybody's gone. What's he going to do? How's he going to handle it? You know, but I don't know. You know, I could probably tell you now that I felt nervous, but I don't think I could have articulated it to you at the time. You know, I wouldn't have been able to say it. But they did, you know. They all left, and my brother and his girlfriend invited me over to dinner that Friday night. And I remember going over there, not really knowing why I was going over there. You know, I mean, my brother, he's my brother. He's reaching out to me. He knows I'm going to be by myself. You know, he's trying to do something nice for me. Why? Whatever. And I remember I just couldn't wait for that dinner to be over. You know, it's like he kept bringing out more food. He kept bringing out, you know, there was like an appetizer, and then there was salad, and then there was this, and then he wanted to go sit out on the front porch and eat dessert. And I was just like, God, can't this just be over? Can't I just go home? God. And I did. And I woke up Saturday morning. You know, Saturday morning kind of happened the same way a lot of my other Saturdays were going. I had a pretty cool routine. I'd wake up in the morning. I'd go to the gym. I worked out at this place kind of near grounds. So when I would get out of the gym, I would walk instead of taking the bus, because I still don't know how to drive. And I would walk through grounds to the corner. Some buddies of mine ran a tattoo shop there, so I would often just go and shoot the shit, hang out for an hour, 2 hours, whatever. And then I would walk back downtown and back home. And, you know, I did this more times than I could even count, and still do sometimes. But this time was different. You know, when you walk down, you know, University Avenue, Main Street in Charlottesville, when you go between the corner and downtown Charlottesville, you have to walk by this ABC store. You know, and you know, it's on the right when you're walking when you're walking home. And you know, I must have passed that thing 100 times. You know, never even thought to go inside. Didn't even enter my mind. And that day, it didn't even enter my mind that I should go inside either. But sure enough, I found myself inside. And I didn't think too much about why I was there, what I was doing there, the consequences of what might happen if I stayed there. You know, as it says in the literature, you know, we're incapable of bringing forward with enough power, you know, those memories, those things that we need to remember. You know, we can't do it in those real tenuous times. And I was looking for a bottle of absinthe. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with absinthe, but there's a whole sort of, there's a ritual that goes involved with drinking it. You know, it's not just pour it, drink it, done. You know, there's a whole thing with a spoon and some sugar and you do this thing, you know. And, you know, all the bottles of absinthe they had were just so expensive. And again, it wasn't even, you know, I didn't even tell myself I'm going to buy one. I was just looking at them and going, these are a lot more expensive than I remember. So I started to walk away, made my way for the door. And this nice woman behind the counter says, "Hey, sugar, can I help you with something?" And I turned around and said, "Actually, I've been browsing. However, I didn't find anything that was in my price range." And she points to a nice display on the counter, some new brand they've got, and said, "Hey, we got a special on this brand this week. Why don't you try this?" And I found my way home with it. And I remember, you know, it wasn't even like I thought this is a good idea or this is a bad idea. I didn't think at all. It just happened, you know. And I remember, you know, somebody stopping by the house. You know, somebody that I knew, they were like borrowing a DVD or returning something that they had borrowed or something. And I remember, you know, she came in and I was overwhelmed. I was like, I have to show her. I have to show her that I have this bottle. I have to. It's in the kitchen. We're in the living room. I have to just, what is a good reason why I can call her into the kitchen to show her this bottle that I have? And I didn't know why. I just became overwhelmed. It's like, I got to show her. I got to. Have to figure it out, but I couldn't. I couldn't think of a good enough reason to be like, "Oh yeah, by the way, here's this bottle of liquor." So I didn't. And I think we know how that night ended. You know, it ended with that ritual I was talking about. It ended with that oblivion I was talking about. You know, I don't do this halfway. You know, I don't drink this to just try to remember what it's all about and then go about my business. I drank that to get drunk, and I did, and I passed out. You know, I drank it to pass out. I did pass out. And like it says in the literature, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. You know, the feeling that I woke up with the next day, uselessness, self-pity, that everything that I had spent the last 4 years building, this frail idea I had of how not drinking was going to be enough for me, down the tubes, just gone forever. How could I do this? Why would I do this? What was the meaning? What did I get out of it? Nothing. I had nothing to show for it. I did the only thing that I knew how to do at that point, which was I got drunk again. And that was Sunday. My wife was coming back into town on Monday. And I knew that something was going to happen. You know, there were no two ways about it. Something was going to happen. I didn't know if I should tell her. And if I decided to, I didn't know how to tell her. I didn't feel like I could turn to my friends or my family. Because we had all spent such a huge time joking about how I was going to get into trouble while everyone was gone. I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to go back to them and be like, "Oh, by the way, you know how we were all joking? Joke's over." So I called the only person that I could think of who couldn't think any less of me, my ex-wife. And I said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, you know, but, you know, I haven't been drinking for, you know, a number of years. And this weekend, you know, wife was out of town, friends were out of town. I stayed home by myself and I got drunk twice. I said, I don't know what I have to do. I don't know what to do. You know, what am I going to do? I don't know if I should tell her. You know, I don't know. I'm lost, you know. And thankfully, you know, in that moment, you know, there was some clarity on the other side of the phone. Because she said, of course you have to tell her. You know, of course you have to. She goes, I don't know what you're going to say. I don't know when you're going to say it, how you're going to do it. But you can't not tell her what happened. You have to tell her. So wife got home Monday. I sat on it. I sat on it until I got out of work Tuesday. And she picked me up because I still don't know how to drive. And as I got in the car, I said, you know, listen, honey, there's something I have to tell you, and I know it's going to make you mad, but I just need you to kind of, I need to tell you this, I need to be honest about it. You know, while you were gone, I got drunk a couple times. And it was like she didn't even miss a beat. There was not a heartbeat, there was not a breath in between what I said and what she said. She said, you know what this means, right? And I said, no. She says, it means you have to go to AA. And I said, okay, I'll do that. You know, I was terrified of what might happen if I didn't, you know. And so I promised that night I would go and I would look it up online and I would try to find a meeting and I would try to go to the next meeting I could get to. I found a meeting, and that was Tuesday night. I found a meeting on Wednesday night. And so I said, look, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to this meeting. And she said, just tell me this. You know, when I was gone and you got drunk, and I said, yes. So what did you drink? And to this day, I can't tell you why I did it, but I lied to her. I said, Jägermeister, of course. Right? That was my drink, of course. That's what else would I drink? And she said, oh, okay, sure, yeah, good. Okay, good. Well, thank you for telling me. I got home from work Wednesday, the day of my, what would become the day of my first AA meeting. And I go upstairs into the apartment, and she says, do you have something you would like to tell me? No, honey. No, I don't. No. And she said, I'm going to ask you one more time. What did you drink while I was gone? And I said, Jägermeister, we talked about this. That was like my thing when I was drinking all the time. That was my big drink, you know. So that's what I went out and I drank it again. And she said, really? And I said, absolutely. She said, you're absolutely sure? And I said, yes, ma'am, I'm absolutely sure. She reaches behind her back and pulls out the empty bottle of absinthe. You know, everything that I talked about, you know, the remorse, the shame, the self-pity, you know, I to this day don't know why I lied to her. I don't know why I wasn't wholly honest with her. I think it's because I didn't really know what being wholly honest meant. You know, I felt like I could keep secrets as long as nobody got hurt. And what did it matter what I drank if I didn't? You know, does it matter if I drank Jaeger or absinthe or Bud Ice or, you know, whatever? I got drunk. And she was mad. She was furious. And I was, you know, my righteous indignation kicked in. You know, what do you know? You're not an alcoholic. You don't know what it's like for people like me. And we fought up until the moment I slammed the door, and I want to be clear about that, I slammed the door of my house to walk to this AA meeting that I was going to go to, and it was at the University Hospital. So I had to take that same walk in reverse that I had made the Saturday beforehand, and I passed by that same ABC store, and I looked inside and I said, you know what, David, you are worthless. You will never be happy. You can never be happy. You will always be lonely. No one will ever know how you feel. Walk away from here now. Go to that AA meeting. And if when you walk out you don't feel a little better, come right on back here and we'll do this for real. No, I wasn't just going to get drunk again like I had that weekend. I was going to die. Because I knew I knew that's all that was waiting for me at the end of that road. And I was totally okay with that. In that moment, I was totally ready for it. I wanted it. But, you know, for whatever reason I did, I walked away and I went to that AA meeting. And I got there late, feeling real awkward. They're already passing around how it works. And I sit down and they pass me the paper. And David, I think I read step 6. Pass it on. And you know what the topic of the meeting that night was? The topic of the meeting was, we tried to stop drinking on our own. Some of us made it a day, 2 weeks, 3 months, 4 years. But ultimately, our self-knowledge, our willpower was not enough. Here was a room full of people that I had never met in my whole life who didn't know me from Adam. The most they knew about me was, I'm David, I'm an alcoholic, you know. With my two hooded sweatshirts and my beanie hat on, you know, sitting in the back as far away from everybody as I can, all of these complete strangers started telling my story. And you know what? I walked away from that meeting feeling a little better because of it. And that meeting got me to my second meeting. And that meeting got me to my third meeting. And the most incredible thing happened in that third meeting. I was listening to a guy talking. He told a story. He said, he talked about how, like me, you know, he couldn't conceive of a moment where he didn't want to have a drink. But then he came to AA. He got a sponsor. He worked the steps. And then that previous weekend, he had gone out to a party with his wife. Some friends of his wife, nobody he knew at this party. His wife's line of work was totally different from his, so there was no way he was going to be able to, as far as he could tell, strike up a conversation with a stranger even. And he said, this is a situation which I no doubt would have drank in. And he said, but the most incredible thing happened. I walked around with my little red cup full of Sprite. I talked to strangers. Everything was okay. My wife even had a couple drinks. I was the designated driver, so she got to have a good time with her friends. She got to have a couple drinks, which she can do. And then we went home, and at the end of the night, everything was okay. And I thought about it. I thought about that story I told you guys about me being on tour in a completely different time zone and my wife drinking and me thinking that this was the end of the world. But here was this guy who said he was like me. He had done these things, and he was able to be there when his wife had a couple drinks, and everything turned out okay. And I thought about how it works, which had been read at the beginning of all three meetings that I've been to so far. If you've decided you want what we have, I wanted what he had. So, I asked him for his phone number. He willingly gave it. He said, call me anytime you want. You calling me helps me more than it helps you. I didn't really know what that meant, but I decided I would think about it. And within a couple of days, I had called him and I said, you know, I don't know what this means. I don't know where I'm at. I don't know what I'm doing. But I think you've got a pretty good thing going. And if the steps are the way to get there, then I want to do that. And he agreed to take me through the steps. It started out very casually. You know, we would meet at the same meeting I had gone to where I met him. And we'd go out for coffee afterwards. And we'd read a little bit in the book. We'd talk about, you know, he would share some experiences based on things that we were reading. I would share some experiences as, you know, the thoughts would come to me. And then eventually we shifted from coffee shops to we started meeting at his home office. And, you know, I'll never, you know, the first time I did a fourth step, you know, I sat down with the instructions in the book, you know, with the experience that had been shared with me by other members of AA and specifically by my sponsor, and I decided I would start doing this resentment list. But as far as I was concerned, I didn't really think I was really resentful towards anybody. So I decided I was going to add a fifth column. I had the four columns from the book, but I was also going to have a fifth column where I would be able to talk about the feelings that I had, which obviously were not resentment, obviously, you know, but it needed to be out there. You know, defiant to the bitter end, you know, the most incredible thing happened as I started writing down some names, and I would go into that extra column I had inserted in the middle, and I would say, how do I feel? Yeah, you know, I guess I am kind of resentful at this guy. No. Move on to the next guy. Well, yeah, you know, I guess I'm kind of resentful about this, too. You know, the next situation or institution or person or whatever it was. You know, I guess I kind of feel resentful at them as well. You know, had to learn the hard way that the instructions that were given in the book are given the way they are because they really work that way. A bunch of other people have already tried this, and that maybe I should just pay attention to what these other people had done instead of trying to once again impose my own will. And I did it, you know, and I did the fifth step with him too. And I'll never forget, you know, again, going through this list of people who I felt had harmed me. And there were a couple guys on it specifically that I laid it all out for him. And I said, look, these guys fucked me. I had no part in this. They just screwed me over. Nothing I could have done would have changed it. And he looked at me and went, what if? And I knew that was it. I knew everything I had was just like, you know, but I needed that. I needed the gentle, sometimes gentle, sometimes forceful correction of a sponsor. Because he had been through this already. He had already done a fourth step. He had already done a fifth step. You know, it wasn't my business to decide how this was going to go. I needed to just let go and allow whatever was going to happen. And, you know, when I did that fifth step with him, you know, it's the same old story. You know, I had a bunch of things on there that I had told myself I was never going to tell another human being that were going to come with me to my grave. Because I knew in my heart of hearts that if you guys knew this stuff about me, man, being deported was not going to be enough, you know. You guys were going to get me out. You were going to, my plane was going to disappear over the Colombian Islands, and I was never going to be heard from again if you knew this stuff. But I did. I told him. You know, I let that stuff go. I told him everything. And when I opened my eyes again and I looked at him, I didn't see judgment. I didn't see anger. I didn't see any of these things that I had spent my whole life thinking were going to happen. What I saw was pure, unconditional acceptance and love. And you know, when I try to think about what a spiritual experience might be, I think that that's a spiritual experience. I realized for the first time in my life that there is something that no matter what I did or said, what happened, you know, that wasn't the end. You know, I wasn't going to die because of these things. I wasn't going to die because somebody else knew about these things. Every other significant spiritual experience that I had had thus far in my life, any time I had felt close to my conception of God, manifested or unmanifested, came back to me in that moment. You know, it wasn't like I willed them into my brain. It was just they were there automatically. You know, and the literature says that, you know, after we do the fifth step, we start to feel like we're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, you know, and that wide open road it talks about. God, I must have floated home from that. But what I came away from that experience with more than anything was I saw it. I saw the person I was, and I saw the person that I could become. And I looked at that person and said, I can't be that guy anymore. The guy who said and did those things, the guy who ran over anyone who got in his way, you know, the guy who was willing to fight and die just to be able to prove he was right, no matter who got hurt. You know, I had to look back at that guy and I went, I can't be that anymore. I can't. And I think that I was willing to accept by then that I didn't know how to get where I needed to be. You know, that these guys, you guys, had gotten me to a point where I could see what had happened. And so I trusted that you guys were going to get me past that and take me where I needed to get. And what that meant was I needed to do some amends. And I hear people talk about doing the amends. I hear two clear schools of thought on the amends. One is that you do the hard ones first, get them out of the way. And the other one is that you start small and easy to sort of work your way into how you're going to do this process, and then you can tackle the big ones. Well, my sponsor believed in tackling the big ones up front, which meant a very tenuous phone call, again, to my ex-wife. And then to her parents. And then to the people that I used to play music with, to the members of my family, to all of these people who I had harmed in my selfish, self-centered, fear-driven actions. And, you know, they all said the same thing to me. And I'm pointing again to the literature. Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. You know, I don't know if my experience is unique or not, but I've yet to have a negative result of the amends process. You know, I went, I said, here are the things that I did. I said, is there anything I've left out that you would like to talk about? And when I said that, I shut my mouth and I listened. And sometimes it was okay. Sometimes, in the experience with my ex-wife, she said, all of this stuff you've talked about, you know, I never thought we would have this talk. I never thought we would get to have this conversation. You know, and when I talked to her father, you know, I could hear him on the other side of the phone, you know, crying. And he told me, you know, I never stopped loving you, ever. You know, he said, my only regret now is that we're not doing this face to face. You know, I wish I would have said we could do this face to face. That's not the end of my story, you know. I got here not because of anything that I've done magically, you know, because of any major decision that I made, because of some, you know, innate ability I have to be awesome. You know, none of that is what got me here, you know. I hate to again point to the cliche, but, you know, my best thinking got me drunk. My best thinking ruined relationships. It did not fix them. You know, my best thinking hurt people. It did not help them. You know, but the outcome of all of this is that I've gotten connected to a community. You know, I have a sponsor who instilled in me the importance of joining a home group. You know, for a long time, you know, my first year, I was like, what's the big deal with a home group? Who cares, man? As long as I go, as long as I'm there, what does it matter if I'm a member of the home group? What does it matter if I'm setting up chairs? What does it matter if I'm making coffee? You know, defiant to the bitter end, again, I was, you know. Luckily, my sponsor wasn't going to have that, and he told me that I needed to join a home group and that I needed to get a job in that home group. And what I've come to figure out is that the reason why that's important is because I owe you guys everything, everything in my whole life. But if I'm not willing to come here and be a part of you guys and help set these meetings up, then the next guy who comes in is not going to get to have the same experience that I've had. He's going to walk in. You know, I think about how I walked in here, feeling worthless, feeling like my life had no point, feeling like I was never going to have friends, no one was ever going to understand me, that I was a failure as a person, as a husband. You know, I was a failure at everything. But you guys changed all that for me, you know? You guys took everything that I had. You accepted me. You showed me the way. You guided me through the way, even. You didn't just tell me the way. You held my hand as I was going. And I have to be that in order. I have to be here for the next guy. I don't know when that guy's going to come. I don't know what he's going to look like, what his name's going to be. I don't have the luxury of knowing. You know, I get to come here now. I don't have to come here now. I get to come here now. You know, I get to meet all of these beautiful people who I've never met before. You know, and I get to hear things continuously. I've never been to an AA meeting where I didn't hear something that was going to help me. You know, I didn't always want to hear it, but I always heard exactly what I needed to hear. You know, I firmly believe now that my purpose in this life is to be of maximum usefulness to God and to my fellows. And, you know, you're my fellows, people in this room, people out of this room. You know, everywhere I go, you know, if I do anything right, it's because I'm not thinking about me. It's because I'm not following my first instinct. It's because I'm following the example that has been put forward by you guys. And I think that if I continue to do these things, if I continue to ask for help when I need it, if I continue to put my hand out even when I don't feel like it, you know, if I say to myself, I don't want to go to that meeting, and I go anyway, you know, if I talk to my sponsor and I'm open and honest with him, you know, if I'm open and honest with the trusted members of my home group and my friends in these rooms, you know, my sponsor has a saying, and I guess I'm getting kind of close to the wire here, so maybe I'll say this and shut it down. My sponsor always tells me that if we live by spiritual principles, we will be protected, you know. And I don't mean that in this way of like everything's going to turn out the way it's supposed to, so just take your medicine and stop crying. You know, ever since I got here, you know, I don't know. I owe it all to you guys. Everything that I have outside of these rooms happened because of what you guys gave me in these rooms. And that's all I've got. Thanks.